Okay, it is my honor and privilege at this time to introduce our speaker for the evening, my sponsor and my best friend and my sister in sobriety, Sylvia.
Sylvia, alcoholic. Okay, I'm done. I'm blank. Welcome to the newcomers. If you don't hear something that you can relate to in my pitch today, come back and listen to somebody else. And I'm getting the signal that I need to speak up. It is an honor and a privilege to be up here sharing my experience, strength, and hope. Because that's what I listened to, was other people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. I want to say happy birthday to the birthday people. It's a way that we recognize our efforts to stay sober and work this program. I had a wonderful day today. I got up sober. My head was clear. I had a puppy dog tongue in my nose and my ear. But, I got to do the things that I wanted to do. My head didn't hurt, I got to go to Santa Barbara and spend a few hours with a sponsee. I got to come home and polish my bike. And I got to ride it here and be with you. For me, that's a wonderful day. My life wasn't like that for a long time. Where to start? I like starting with the miracles in my life because they're what I recognize that reminds me that there's a power greater than myself in my life. I wasn't born in this country. I was born in Germany, and I came to America when I was 4 with my 3 brothers and my parents. And it was an adventure because we knew nothing about it. I grew up in a household where kids were seen and not heard, and you just did what you were told. So, we get up, told to pick your favorite toy, get on an airplane, and the next thing I know, I'm getting up in a strange house. People don't understand me. I don't understand them. They're beating the crap out of us and calling us names. That was the first time that I felt shame because I learned what that name Nazi meant. And I hid my heritage for a very long time because I owned that, my parents eventually bought a house and we moved to a nice neighborhood. And there were 3 girls on that block around my age, and they became my very close friends until they weren't. And for some reason, they decided that I wasn't someone they wanted to play with anymore. And I thought that was just for the day, but it was for years. And I learned to live, play by myself with my imagination and I learned to be by myself a lot. My 3 brothers, when I was around 7 years old, my older brother decided that I was his play toy. And I learned to hide from him. My mother worked during the summertime, and we had to go to the public park. She'd drop us off and pick us up when she got done with work. I learned where not to go, and going to the bathroom was not a place that I could go because that's where I would get tracked down. So I would sit out on the open, pick the flowers and weave them together and just do whatever I could to pass the time and be safe. And consequently, I would pee my pants. And I would sit there, and I never told my mom why. In fact, I never told her until I was 39 years old. That was another shame that I carried for a long time. But one day when I was sitting in that park, this girl I'd never seen before comes up to me and sits down next to me and starts talking and starts weaving flowers with me and takes my phone number, and she lives in a different town. And we became friends over the phone, and she was my first friend after several years. My parents came home one day, I'm about 10, and they said, well, everybody in the car, because we're going to go look at our new house. And we get in the car and we look at our new house, and it's two doors away from my phone friend. And I call that a miracle. And that was just the start of the miracle, because when I found that out, I had two thoughts. I was, one, elated, and the second thought was, oh my God, she's going to know what my family's like. Because my family was dysfunctional, violent. My father was a very heavy drinker. Things flew. Kids flew. You know, voices were loud, and I'm feeling another shame. Well, as it turns out, her family was the same, and she was going to Alateen. And so by the time I'm 11 years old, I'm going to Alateen with her, not because my parents are taking me, not because her parents are taking her, but because we wanted to go. And I grew up in LA by the International Airport, and it was a very strong program there. There were meetings every night, and we went to them. There were conventions, there were roundups, there were river rafting trips, there were all kinds of things for us to do. And I made lifelong friends. Jill is still in my life. I still communicate with her. I just was up north and visited another friend that I've known since I was 13 and from Alateen. And the reason that I bring that up, several reasons. One, it saved my life. I had a place to go that was safe. I had adults, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous adults, raising me, teaching me, walking me through hard stuff. I had Al-Anon sponsor that ran the meetings and worked with us to help us understand what alcoholism was in our parents. The other reason that I say that is because this is a family disease, and I see children in here, you know? We all have mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and family members, you know, that have supported us, and mine supported me even when I didn't think they were. The other reason that I say it that is because I have two brothers that passed from this disease. One took his life at 21, left a note, said he couldn't take it anymore. And the other one in his third detox, he decided to walk home and do it on a railroad track. And the autopsy showed that he was not sober. What I've learned in these rooms is that it can get you one way or another, either with your health or an accident. What it also did, going through Alateen and when I graduated from Alateen because of my age, going into Al-Anon, it kept me from drinking. because it gave me it gave me a healthy fear of it. But it didn't give me an immunity to alcoholism. And there came a time in my life where drinking became okay for me. When I graduated high school, I packed up my 64 Chevy Malibu, car I wish I had today. And I moved from LA up to San Francisco area, the Bay Area. And yes, I was a flower child. I had flowers and ribbons in my hair. I sold stained glass on Fisherman's Wharf and, you know, and I did all that. And you know, surprisingly enough, I did it sober. Also at that time, I was going to college. And I was working with the Council on Alcoholism, and I had an hour-long program that I took to schools. I took to high schools and junior highs, and I spoke to the kids about alcohol, alcoholism, and what they could do if it was in their families. So I continued to be of service. But you know, around 20, I met him. And we had a wonderful life. We were together for 20 years. During that time, we built a house from the ground up with our hands. We both had careers in construction that with tool belts, building high-rises in San Francisco. We built an airplane, and we flew it. That doesn't happen all the time. Only 10% of them fly. And, you know, life was good. I went back to school and got a degree in construction management and got a job as an estimator project manager. So now I was on the other side of the fence. And I was negotiating the jobs, bidding them, negotiating them, building them, managing them from signing the contract to cutting the ribbon. My husband went back to school and became an attorney. And somewhere along the line, things got different, things got hard, things got crazy, and drinking started to be okay. And it was, I can't sleep. So I'd get up and I'd pour a glass of wine and I'd just down it right at the sink. You know, it started to be an every night thing. Come home, pour a glass of wine, make dinner. Never thought about it being, never thought about the reason that I was drinking, because I'm an adult now, you know? This is what adults do, I thought. Well, somewhere around 30s, I decided that it was time to leave the relationship. And I did. And my drinking took a turn then because there was nobody watching anymore. There wasn't any, there was nobody watching. And I also did a geographical. I moved from, excuse me. I moved from the Bay Area to the Central Coast, and they don't build high-rises here. So my move wasn't thought through very well. Yeah, I lived in Rio Grande for about 10 years. And I met someone there, and we started a relationship. And we took this very old house that had never been touched, and we remodeled it by ourselves for 5 years. And during those 5 years, I took a test with ExxonMobil, and I passed. I didn't think I did, and so after the test, we all went down to the local bar and we drowned our sorrows in, you know, as much beer as we could drink and pizza and all that good stuff. But I did pass the test. And I got a job working offshore on the three platforms just on the other side of the tunnel. And I was an operator out there. So I'm out there for 7 days stone cold sober. And I'm home for 7 days not sober. And, you know, it never crossed my mind that that was a problem. It's just like, you know, you get 7 days off, you know, the minute I walked in the house, the cork popped out of the bottle and it never got put back in. So we remodeled that house for 5 years, drinking and unfortunately, that was a very unhealthy relationship for me. About a year and a half in, I discovered that it was an unhealthy relationship and I should leave. But my MO is I stick around too long. I just stay because I get myself paralyzed with fear, and in order to not feel anymore, I will drink. And for the next 5 years, I drank very heavily. And at one point, I took my car and I almost went off a cliff. And I woke up just in time to pull it to the right and not go over the cliff. Destroyed my car because it hit the wood fence. And I lied. I said that I had hit on Highway 1 because that's where I was going. I was just driving on Highway 1 after drinking a full bottle of wine. And the police believed me. They never asked me if I'd been drinking. My partner believed me. And that didn't turn any light bulbs on. Not at all. Because I'm still holding down a job. I'm still paying the bills. I'm still remodeling a house. I'm still doing what I believe is being a responsible person, doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing in life as an adult. So I just drank at home. I didn't drive anymore. I just drank at home. And created this incredible Mediterranean garden and would be out there as much as I could because that's where I could hide the bottles of wine and drink. About 5 years in, I started to have a pain in my hip. And I got off the couch one day and I just collapsed. I could not stand up. And for the next 2.5 years, the doctors, five different doctors, even UCLA and Stanford, couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I wound up in a wheelchair. I drank. I drank to hide, to cover the pain. I took Vicodin to cover the pain because it was prescribed. I told my mom that I was dying because I truly believed that I was dying. And, you know, when I talk about miracles and I talk about God walking in my life and helping me when I can't, I had learned about, and I had the opportunity to have a higher power of my own choosing at a very young age. And it was so powerful to know that it's not my parents. It's not my brothers. You know, it's something far greater than anything that I can imagine. But as I was going through life, that stopped being a daily important part of my life. And I started to pray again. I just prayed for a solution. And I didn't know what I was praying for. I was praying for a solution for the unhealthy relationship and for the pain in my hip. I was not praying for a solution for my drinking because I didn't think I had a problem. There was no issue with my drinking. I wasn't hurting anyone. I was just home feeling numb. Well, this woman that I work with comes to me, and she puts a card down on my office desk, and she says, "Sylvia, you need to talk to this person." And it was a psychiatrist. Okay, I can take a suggestion. And I did call her, and I spoke with her, and I had meetings with her, and she helped me to realize that I did need to leave the relationship. But at the time, I'm still in a wheelchair, and I have isolated myself so much that all the people that have been in my life for 30, 40 years, my parents, the people that I grew up in Alateen, the people that have known me for so many years, I had pushed away. I didn't, in my mind, have anyone that could help me. So not long after that, that same friend put another card on my table, and it was for a surgeon. And she says, "You need to talk to this person." And so I did. I made an appointment, and this doctor just told me, "Sylvia, you need a new hip." And I went to get a new hip. And it was that feeling of hope, that feeling that there is a solution, that I can get out of this wheelchair, I can stop using crutches at work, I can put that cane like Tiny Tim in the corner, and I was going to be able to walk again. So I said my prayers on the gurney as I got rolled in, and I said, "God, this is my new beginning." And little did I know, he had a whole lot more in store for me. The doctor called me when I woke up, and he said, "I apologize, Sylvia," because I had told him I was dying too. And he said, "You're absolutely right, you were dying. You have a bacterial infection that I don't recognize, I've never seen before, and in about 6 months you would have been in an emergency room and they would have not have known what to do because your organs would have been shutting down and they'd already started." So here we go. 3 months at home, in bed, antibiotic drip, hour and a half morning, hour and a half at night. And no drinking. Does that sound familiar to anybody? 90 days? It did wonders for me. It gave me a clarity that I hadn't had in a very long time. And I continued to connect with that power greater than myself. I started to say the Serenity Prayer again. I had more hope than I had had in years. Um, 27 days after I got out of that bed and went back to work, I stopped in San Ynez at the gas station, and I saw a newspaper, and it was the San Ynez Times. And I didn't know where San Ynez was, and I picked it up, and I went to the Marriott across the street, and I found a bench, and I sat there, and I said, "God, show me my safe house." And there was a cottage in there. I had been dreaming of this blue cottage. And there was a cottage in there, and I called the lady, and she had me come over, and I looked at it, and it was blue and white. And I was honest with her. I told her, I said, you know, you may not want to take me on as a tenant because I'm running away from a relationship, and I don't know how safe I can make this. I hope this is my safe house. And she said, Sully, there are about 5 people ahead of you, but this is yours. So the hard part was to go home and say that I'm leaving. And I did. And I packed up my fat chihuahua in a suitcase and I left. And I moved to Santa Ynez. And my therapist said, Sylvia, you need to go back to that support group that you felt comfortable in. So I call, no, I go online and I'm looking for Al-Anon. Okay? And I find an address and a day, and I'm going to go to an Al-Anon meeting. It's Monday night at Bethania. Okay? And I walk in, and there's 2 guys there in a truck, and I hear them say, well, the meeting got moved. And so I go, hey, you know, I'm looking for the meeting. And they go, oh, well, follow us. And I wind up in an AA meeting. And, you know, as uncomfortable as it was for me at the time, I sat and I listened. And, of course, I'm the new face in a small town, and I got called on, and I made my apologies and, you know, said this isn't what I was looking for. And I got the, oh, yeah, right. So I tried again. Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, another Al-Anon meeting. And I walk in, and there's this lady in the room, and I go, this is Al-Anon, right? I was going to be safe this time. I was going to make sure. And she said, AA's over there. This is 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. So I asked her again, and she didn't let me finish asking. She just said, AA's in that room over there. And, you know, I just looked up because I knew that's where I was being directed. And I didn't know why, and I just said, okay. And I walked in there, and it was a women's meeting, and they were about 12. And, you know, what I heard was a similarity to my thinking, to the things that I had done that I didn't share with anybody in my life, a similarity that I thought nobody else could be like me. You know, nobody else could be hiding their alcohol like I did. Nobody else could be drinking for the effect so that you didn't feel, so that you could get numb. I didn't try to find Al-Anon anymore. I started to go to AA. But it took me a while. It took me a while to hear my story. It took me a while to admit in my innermost self that I was not immune to alcoholism because of my experience with Alateen and AA and Al-Anon. Controlled drinking. You know, when I moved into that little house, I had to buy a refrigerator. And this is before I wound up in the AA meeting. What did I do? I went to the grocery store and I filled it with a bag of grapes, some cheese, and all the wine it would hold. Because I didn't want to have to stop on my way home from work at the store. I wanted to just go home, pop that cork, and have my glass of wine, except that it wasn't a glass anymore. It was 2 bottles. And when I started to go to AA, I did not stop drinking right away. I had well, Christ, the meetings are at 8 o'clock at night. You know, I got home at 5. You know, what am I going to do for those 2 hours? But it's the people in this fellowship that did not leave me alone. They came to my house to sit and talk with me. They approached me at the meetings. They accepted me and welcomed me and saw me a whole lot better than I saw myself at that time. I called my friend Jill that I moved next to, and I told her, you know, my therapist says, well, maybe I'm a high bottom drunk or high bottle drunk or whatever. And she shared with me, you know, Sylvia, most of the people that we went to Alateen with are in AA now. So join the club, you know? And yeah, I recognized the craving. I had never thought that I was craving. I just thought it was my choice. Oh, I'm deciding to have another glass. Or I'm deciding to have a glass. You know, and reading the doctor's opinion and understanding what alcoholism really is to the body, to the mind, to the spirit is what gave me the understanding in my innermost self that, yeah, I came in here spiritually broke. I came in here with a desperation that I didn't understand. And a physical malady that I have yet to experience some of the things that I have heard experienced in these rooms. And I'm grateful for that, but my experiences have been the same as far as what's on the inside by working these steps, by finding a sponsor that I can be accountable to, that reminds me that this is an honor and a privilege, and that I can be of service to others and give away what's been so freely given to me. I have the opportunity to work with H&I, and I have two H&I commitments. That one I've had for 4 years. Oh gosh, it's going on 5. My sobriety date is June 20th, 2008. And you know, it keeps me in touch with where I came from, and it keeps me in service with those that that I just hope stay. I get to work with some wonderful women that have given me a whole lot more than I could imagine, because it helps me to go through the steps one more time and to be accountable to myself and to them as well. I'm not in a wheelchair anymore. I ride a motorcycle now. And that is a gift in sobriety, that, you know, I used to fly an airplane and it was hard to let go of that, but, you know, that's a different part of my life. And now I get to do something that brings me a lot of joy and with people that I care about. So, I am, I think that I'm done, and I thank you all for letting me be of service.
Thank you, Sylvia, for speaking tonight. Also,